From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, along with rampaging dinosaurs and The Incredibles, one of the box office stars this summer is Mr. Rogers. How'd that happen? Morgan Neville, the director of the hit documentary Won't You Be My Neighbor, has a theory.
Those of us who grew up with him had a connection with him that predates almost anything else in our life. And there's something about spending time with him that asks us to revisit a part of ourselves we haven't visited in a very, very long time.
And singer-songwriter Mary Gaucher makes music with military vets in her latest album, Rifles and Rosary Beads. All that coming right up. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. We begin today with one of the unlikeliest box office hits of the summer. Yes, that is the opening music to Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, the beloved children's TV program, which debuted in February of 1968. Fred Rogers created and hosted the series. He was also the writer, composer, puppeteer, and voice of the puppets in the show. In the documentary Won't You Be My Neighbor, director Morgan Neville traces the program's surprising path to success. Meanwhile, his film is its own success, so far grossing more than $13 million since its June release. When I talked with Morgan Neville before the film premiered, I asked him why he thought Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood became such a massive success.
I think it was because of him, you know, because of the trueness of his message and the way he was able to communicate with kids, that everything else was really secondary. And he created this really unique vision that was not only ahead of its time and apart from its time, but is unique in history. I mean, people are still not doing the things he was doing on his show.
Was part of the motivation for making the film kind of this exploration into the separation and overlap between the man and the character, and about who he was in private and who he was on television and how much of one mirrored the other? And was this guy for real, basically?
Well, I mean, that is the essential question. And there's actually this great book that he put out, a collection of letters he got and his responses to them. And it's one of my favorite things. He got more letters at one point than anybody in America, and he personally responded to every single letter. But the first letter in this book starts with, "Are you for real? Please tell me if you are for real, Mr. Rogers." And I think that's kind of essentially the question we all have. Like, is this guy for real? Like, can he really be this character? You know, what is the difference between the man and the character? And we're so used now to seeing this huge divide between our TV heroes and the people who play them. So I'm here to report that he's the same person, you know, but not exactly the same. And in many ways, Fred Rogers, as opposed to Mr. Rogers, was this deep thinker. He was a Presbyterian minister. He had a graduate degree in childhood development. He was a seeker. He wanted to learn his whole life, and he wanted to minister to people. He spoke many languages. He was a pacifist vegetarian. I mean, there are many intriguing things about him. And so in many ways, I think that Fred Rogers is actually a better character than Mr. Rogers, because he's a more dimensional version of what you would want Mr. Rogers to be.
And he also recognized, I think, before a lot of people did, that there was something really noxious about what children were seeing on television, and that he recognized that there needed to be some sort of corrective alternative, that he was motivated not just, you know, to put on a show, but to put on a show that wasn't even close to anything that was being produced or broadcast.
Yeah, I mean, he had this moment of kind of staggering insight when he came home from a college break, and this would have been 1949. His parents had gotten a television, and not many people had them at that point, and he had never seen it before. And on spring break, he was watching it and watching these shows where people were throwing pies in each other's faces and laughing. And he knew in that moment that this new device was going to change our society, and that there would be generations of children raised by this new box, and that somebody had to look out for them. And in that moment, he told his parents he was going to change his major. He was going to basically take a new life course. And instead of becoming a minister immediately, he decided to move to New York and used his family's connections to get a job at NBC and worked at Rockefeller Center for several years to learn the ins and outs of television. And I think there's something about the timing of it that if Fred Rogers had been born, I think even 5 years sooner or later, the show never would have happened. It was the perfect synchronicity of, you know, the right man with the right medium at the right time.
I think a lot of people also forget just how revolutionary his show was in dealing with topics like death, divorce, violence, segregation. Here's a cut from a special episode of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood that aired in primetime after the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy in June of 1968. It's just 2 months after the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr.
What does assassination mean? Have you heard that word a lot today?
Yes. And I didn't know what it meant.
Well, it means somebody getting killed in a sort of surprise way.
It's unbelievable what he's dealing with and how he's talking about such a serious issue. Was that something that he felt was almost part of his duty to children?
Without a doubt. I mean, that specific episode, which was a special episode that happened because Bobby Kennedy had been assassinated on a Wednesday night, and the funeral was going to be broadcast on Saturday morning nationally. And Mr. Rogers knew that children were going to be home and they were going to understand that something bad had happened. And kids are way too smart to say, don't worry about it. They know when something's wrong. And so he said, I need to make a special, which he threw together and it aired that Friday night, the night before the funeral, for parents to understand how to talk to their kids about what had happened. And for him, that was something he forced on the network and forced people to do, because he said, well, this is exactly why I'm here. And he did versions of that in the wake of numerous tragedies over decades. But he really felt like it was in those moments that he was at his best. And it was really when I was thinking about making this film, and I went and I visited the archives in Latrobe, Pennsylvania at the Fred Rogers Center. And I'd heard about this episode, which hadn't been seen in years, and I had them put it up for me and I watched it. And at the end of watching that episode, I knew I had to make this film. It was just that clear to me that all the dimension, everything I wanted to say was embodied in that episode.
Coming up, Morgan Neville reveals how Fred Rogers' childhood informed the show that he created. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Make sure you tune in tomorrow when we'll discuss this year's Emmy nominations, and I sit down with musician Bea Beeman to talk about protest songs. But now let's get back to my conversation with filmmaker Morgan Neville. His documentary, Won't You Be My Neighbor, is about Fred Rogers, the creator and star of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Rogers was an unusual TV personality with his quiet voice and cozy cardigan. He was an ordained Presbyterian priest, and in some ways, he saw his show as a kind of ministry. Neville's film explores Rogers' childhood in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, and its influence on the show. Here's Morgan Neville, the director of Won't You Be My Neighbor.
His family was wealthy, and they owned a factory in the town. And in the wake of the Lindbergh kidnapping, his parents kept him kind of under latchkey. And on top of that, he had a number of illnesses, and he was overweight. And so he kind of grew up by himself in his bedroom, playing piano and playing with puppets. And he remained incredibly in touch with everything he thought and felt as a child. So I think he went back to his own childhood again and again and again to figure out what kids needed to hear. And Daniel Tiger really became the purest embodiment of who Fred was as a child and what Fred's fears were. And even more than that, I think about this a lot, that, you know, Daniel Striped Tiger was a tame tiger. He talked a lot about taming one's emotions. And I think Fred understood that children acted out not out of anger, but out of the underlying cause, which was fear. So I think Fred always tried to figure out what made kids fearful and how to help them understand those things in kind of age-appropriate ways.
There's also this song that Mr. Rogers wrote that I think is as much, you know, a statement of his theology as it is about his belief about the world. It's called It's You I Like. And it seems to get at so much of what he's about and what he is kind of in a way preaching. There's an episode where he sings it with a boy who's quadriplegic who's using a wheelchair. His name is Jeff Erlinger. Let's listen to this.
It's you I like. It's not the things you wear. It's not the way you do your hair. But it's you I like. The way you are right now. The way down deep inside you. Not the things that hide you. Not your fancy chair. That's just beside you.
I mean, Fred said that clip was his favorite clip of all 33 years of shows. And I know why, because in a way, it's Fred at his best, which is looking at something difficult and making us understand how to normalize it. You know, something like having handicapped children on your TV show, he did it numerous times, not just that one time. And to this day, how many handicapped kids do you see on TV? You know, very few to none. So for him, I think that's really kind of why he was put on television, why he was put on Earth, was for moments like that.
One of the things that I had forgotten is that he tried to make an adult version of his show called Old Friends, New Friends. What was the motivation behind that, and how did it turn out?
I think he thought he could broaden the audience and investigate other things that were interesting to him. And the show Old Friends, New Friends, he did two seasons of it. It's actually a fascinating series. And he did episodes with Milton Berle and Hoagy Carmichael and, you know, a neurosurgeon and all kinds of, he went to a jail. But the show was a failure. And I've thought a lot about why that is. And part of it is, I think kids are really, really good at saying exactly what they are thinking or expressing exactly how they're feeling. And I think as we grow up, we learn to mask our feelings and hide our intentions. That's part of what being an adult is, for better or worse. And Fred had no tolerance for any of that. Fred always spoke to you very directly with laser focus and would cut through whatever shields you had up. And I think a lot of adults just were uncomfortable with it. I think they just couldn't handle somebody being that emotionally direct in that time as he was.
One of the things that I found kind of odd is that there was a strain of criticism about Mr. Rogers and about Fred Rogers, which was kind of tied to entitlement and, I guess in its kind of simplest form, the idea that he would say that every kid is special just for being who they are was somehow really uncomfortable for a lot of people to grasp and understand and appreciate.
Yeah, there was a certain amount of kind of op-ed speak that basically had a very simplistic critique, you know, that millennials were now an entitled generation because Mr. Rogers told them they were special. And I think where they all miss the point is that it was never about expressing that everybody was entitled to worth. It was about protecting kids from feeling worthless and understanding that we all have some purpose here, that we all should respect ourselves enough. And that was really it. It was looking out for the people who felt powerless and for children that felt that they had nobody else looking out for them. And that's something he finally defined in the last speech he ever gave, his last commencement address.
It's not the honors and the prizes and the fancy outsides of life which ultimately nourish our souls. It's the knowing that we can be trusted, that we never have to fear the truth, that the bedrock of our lives from which we make our choices is very good stuff.
It's very difficult to watch your documentary and not be moved to tears. A lot of people in the office who watched it did the same thing. You knew exactly what they were watching when they started dabbing at their cheeks. And I think it even happened when the trailer dropped. So what is it about Mr. Rogers that moves people to tears? What do you think is behind that?
I wish I could bottle it. I don't, you know, it's, I mean, I have thought a lot about it. And the film still gets me emotional. You know, even as we were finishing the film and watching it back again and again, we kept getting emotional watching it. And I think part of it is that those of us who grew up with him had a connection with him that predates almost anything else in our life. You know, next to our family members, it's probably the oldest relationship we have. And there's something about spending time with him that asks us to revisit a part of ourselves we haven't visited in a very, very long time. Our own, I guess you could call it inner child. But there's something about the directness with which he speaks. Like I said, he had that laser focus in his way of cutting through all the adult filters and shields and getting right to the core of what it is. And the experience to me of watching the film is finally you have to kind of succumb to his directness. You kind of have to give in and say, okay, I'm willing to be emotionally open as you are. You know, I'm willing to be vulnerable, because Fred was incredibly vulnerable always. And I think you finally have to kind of meet him on those grounds, because he would have it no other way. He always made you come to him.
The film ends with this almost existential question of what Fred would be doing in today's world. It's almost impossible to kind of figure what his message would be. But I think you and I can agree that he might be even more needed today than he was when his show was on the air. And I wonder if there is any kind of alternative now to Mr. Rogers. I think about, you know, what young children see on television. I also think about who we can turn to if there's a mass shooting or a natural disaster. And it's a very short list. And there doesn't seem to be any place where you can go where you can get the attention and guidance and love that Mr. Rogers gave so many people when he was on television.
Yeah, I don't think there is new Mr. Rogers. And I've thought a lot about this, too, that, you know, if you think about the legacy of what he did, spending, you know, decades imprinting a little bit of his worldview and trying to impart a sense of kindness to the millions of people that watched him, I think that's where his legacy is. I mean, I really feel like whatever we can activate in ourselves that he left in us, whatever kindness we can remember, whatever neighborliness we can remember, that's what we should think about in terms of the legacy of Mr. Rogers. Because not only do I not see the person, I don't see the room for that kind of figure, which I think is tragic. And I think it's part of why people are so happy to see Mr. Rogers come back. I mean, that gives me hope, the fact that so many people are pining for this kind of kindness, and not, as Fred would say, not in a Pollyanna-ish way, but in an honest goodness, real kindness, for the sake of kindness, remembering that that's as important as everything else. And I feel like our culture keeps sliding the other way, and we have to remember that kindness is the thing that allows us to all live together, to have a neighborhood together. So I think if we can't remember those things, we're going to be in big trouble.
Morgan Neville is the director of the documentary Won't You Be My Neighbor. Morgan, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, John.
Won't You Be My Neighbor is in theaters now. Coming up on The Frame, songwriter Mary Gaucher collaborates with military veterans for her latest album. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. And just a quick reminder, you can get this show as a daily podcast. In one recent episode, we talked with comedian and filmmaker Bo Burnham about his movie Eighth Grade. It's a coming-of-age in the internet age story about a 13-year-old girl. You can find our podcast wherever you like to listen. And now, award-winning singer-songwriter Mary Gaucher brought military veterans and their families into the writing process for her latest album, Rifles and Rosary Beads. KPCC Veteran Affairs reporter Libby Dankman spoke with Gaucher and with a wounded service member who says their collaboration helped heal the invisible injuries of war.
Joshua Gertz joined the Army after high school. He had some uncles who served, and he thought college wasn't for him. That was 1999. Fast forward a few years to Gertz driving a truck on his last night of deployment in Iraq.
My vehicle was hit with a roadside bomb, which left me with brain injury and some spinal cord damage. I'm not wheelchair bound, but it makes things difficult.
It was the psychological wounds that nearly killed Gertz. At one point, after returning home to his wife Lisa and two sons in New York, he attempted suicide.
I felt like I was a burden, and it was almost like I wanted my family to be able to laugh again.
Lisa was looking for help when she came across a news article about a nonprofit that pairs veterans with professional songwriters.
Knowing my love for music, she thought it would be something that I would maybe go to.
Rifles and rosary beads, you hold on.
Gertz grew up near Buffalo in a musical family, but he'd never written a song before. And that's common, says Nashville singer-songwriter Mary Gaucher. She's been volunteering as a mentor with Songwriting with Soldiers for about 5 years. The organization holds several retreats a year all over the country. Each veteran produces a song by the end of the weekend. It's free to service members and their partners. Here's Mary Gaucher.
Soldiers are trained not to be vulnerable, but when they come home, they've got to learn it. And part of telling the story is being uncomfortably vulnerable. But that's what songs do.
War of my baby from my breast, now my name in rank.
This year, Gaucher released an entire album co-written with military veterans from the program. The 11 tracks on Rifles and Rosary Beads dig deep into the veteran experience, including stories you may not typically associate with military service. The song Brothers takes listeners to the emotional deployment of a new mom.
Why my face changed my soaking bra, told my body not to feel at all, tried to be like you, what must I do to prove that I'm a brother too?
I learned a lot writing with Megan Cunahan and Brittany Fadd, being the first generation of females in combat. And the mantra that they had to deal with is no special treatment.
Another track was co-written with half a dozen military wives and songwriter Beth Nielsen Chapman, who wrote the monster hit This Kiss for Faith Hill.
Beth and I sat with the wives, and they started to talk about what they called the war after the war.
There's landmines in the living room, eggshells on the floor. I lost myself in the shadow of your honor and your pain.
They have to serve in silence a lot of the time. And our veterans have told me over and over again, look, the hero here is my wife.
Invisible, the war after the war.
You know, Leonard Cohen said it best, the crack is how the light gets in. We don't connect at our strengths. We connect at our vulnerabilities.
On the first night of the retreat, Josh Gertz came in skeptical. But Gaucher's vulnerable performance convinced him she would be a reliable songwriting partner.
It was just something about her words, being able to express so many complex feelings with such a simple way of saying it.
So they started talking, Gaucher looking for a way to uncover his song.
She said, so, you know, looking back on it, What do you think that one thing that's kind of weighing you down is? And so, I don't know, who the hell knows?
Looking back now, who the hell knows where the soul of a dead soldier goes?
I was just blown away that it could be that simple. And then once I started opening up and being truly honest with her, I think Mary saw where the true hurt, my true pain was coming from.
That song became Still on the Ride. Instead of dwelling on his own life-changing injuries, Gertz chose to memorialize a fallen friend. Thomas Falk died November 7th, 2000, just before their one-year anniversary in the Army.
I shouldn't be here. You shouldn't be gone. But it's not up to me who dies and who carries on.
I mean, we spent pretty much every second of every day together since the day we joined the Army, and he was family.
My eyes, me and my guardian angel were still on the ride.
I shouldn't be here. Why him and not me? With all that, I should be the one. And I think from that kind of stemmed the idea that maybe he went first to be my guardian angel and and make sure I made it through those things.
Double vision, and my stomach's in my...
Gertz says he works every day to maintain his mental health. He's played harmonica on stage with Mary Gaucher on her Rifles and Rosary Beads tour, and he credits Songwriting with Soldiers with helping him open up and trust someone else with his story.
It's always going to be there. You just have better training, better tools to deal with it, and more support to deal with it.
I shouldn't be here. You shouldn't be gone.
For The Frame, I'm Libby Denkman.
But it's not up to me who dies and who carries on.
And that is our show for today. You can keep up with us on Twitter and Instagram at The Frame. You can find me at JG Horn. I'm John Horn. We'll see you back here tomorrow.